This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo was attacked in January, 12 people were killed. The attack was widely understood to be in response to the magazine's publication of cartoons that depicted the Prophet Muhammad. That event sparked a lot of conversation about freedom of expression and about what magazines and cartoonists should publish when it comes to religion or culture. The debate over free speech and the line between satire and provocation has reemerged this month when Charlie Hebdo was given a Penn Freedom of Expression Courage Award and when two attackers were shot dead after opening fire on a so-called Draw Muhammad contest. Today on Vermont Edition, we've asked three Vermont cartoonists to share their views on these events and on the intersection of satire, sensitivity, and freedom of expression. Alison Bechdel is creator of the long-running strip Dykes to Watch Out For and the graphic memoir Fun Home, among others. She's also the recipient of a 2014 MacArthur Genius Grant. Harry Bliss is a cartoonist and cover artist for The New Yorker. He's also a children's book author and has a syndicated single-panel comic called Bliss. And Tim Newcomb is an editorial cartoonist. His cartoons are published weekly in 7 days and regularly picked up by national publications, including the Boston Globe, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. Harry, Tim, and Allison, thanks to all three of you for being with us today.
Thank you, Jane.
Allison, I'd love to start with you because you actually went to the award ceremony, the Penn Awards, after several table hosts pulled out of the ceremony. You wrote about why. Could you share your reasoning?
Well, it was a very complicated decision for me. I said yes immediately because Art Spiegelman was rounding up cartoonists to replace these writers. But at the same time, I could see the point that these writers had been making. So I had to give a lot of thought to this. But I feel like in the end, it was right to go and support the award. You know, what clarified my thinking about it a lot was the attack that happened in Texas last weekend. And in that case, the organization holding that Draw Muhammad event, the American Freedom Defense Initiative, it was really clear to me that that group really is a racist organization. They really are trying to provoke Muslim outrage in a way that Charlie Hebdo was absolutely not trying to do. So that's where I went.
And what was it like at the award ceremony?
What was it like there?
Yeah.
I was surprised at the heavy police presence. There was a lot of police out front of the museum. It was at the Museum of Natural History. And I'm not sure if those people would have been there anyhow, just because it was Charlie Hebdo getting the award, or if maybe security was heightened in the wake of that Texas attack. But there was a lot of police there. Absolutely nothing happened. There was one protester. I didn't see her, but one woman holding up a sign about, you know, why are you punching down? You know, that whole line of reasoning. Don't make fun of people who are more powerless. But only one person was there protesting the event. Otherwise, it was just a regular black tie gala, not that I've ever been to one before.
We're exploring ideas today around satire, free speech, and the role of the cartoonist. And listeners, we'd love to hear from you. If you have thoughts on this or if you have questions for our guests, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Josie posts, not trivializing the horrific events that took place at Charlie Hebdo, but in my opinion, that magazine is trash. Before this happened, they were embattled in lawsuits, barely had a readership of 30,000, and were on the verge of bankruptcy. I think satire is great until it becomes petty, hurtful, and gratuitous. And Carrie says, I fully supported Charlie Hebdo receiving the Penn Award. I believe that the writers who boycotted the event did not read French or understand that it was a liberal, anti-racist magazine. I was very impressed that Penn leaders stood their ground. At the Penn Award ceremony, the Charlie Hebdo editor-in-chief Gerard Biard said, and I'm quoting him here, growing up to be a citizen is to learn that some ideas, some words, some images can be shocking. And he said, being shocked is part of a democratic debate. Being shot is not. Harry Bliss, can you reflect on that, this idea that being shocked is part of a democratic debate?
I think that's absolutely true, and I couldn't agree more. And I think in this country, there are a few examples of shocking satirists, both in the paper, but more specifically on television. Good example would be South Park, you know. And I think that stuff is, it's great satire. It's very much in the same vein as Charlie Hebdo. And unfortunately, those two creators, Trey Parker and Matt Stone's lives have been, I think there's a fatwa against them. So, but certainly it's courageous, very courageous to put out satire that could get you killed. But it, being shot for satirizing any group is just wrong, and there's no place for it.
Yeah, certainly, Tim Newcomb, I don't think anybody would ever say being shot is part of a Democratic debate. But do you agree? Do you agree with Harry Bliss that being shocked is part of a Democratic debate?
Well, I mean, the reactions to this have been so varied. I mean, there was a great editorial
Gary Trudeau?
Well, no, Brooks of the New York Times.
Oh, David Brooks?
David Brooks.
Yeah.
Which he said, you know, everybody's wandering around with these I Am Charlie T-shirts. But in fact, his point was we are not all Charlie. That many, you know, that magazine just wouldn't survive in this country. If he pointed out that if it was printed at any university campus, it would be shut down very quickly for being hate speech. And, you know, in fact, we do have a lot of controls over here, and
So where do you fall on that idea? If you agree with that point of view, that maybe what Charlie Hebdo was doing was racist in your point of view, or could fall afoul of hate speech rules, is there still a role for it, or should it not be out there?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, any part of any kind of a democracy is a full range of debate. And as David Brooks was saying, you know, that as you get older, the life becomes more complicated, nuanced, and so should the debate. I mean, there are cartoons that are printed in Charlie Hebdo that just wouldn't, there would be no way it would be printed over here. There was one when the French president Hollande was revealed he was having an affair. There was a cartoon printed in Charlie Hebdo of the president, I'm not sure how much I can describe this on air, standing there with his zipper down and kind of hanging out there for everyone to see. And there's no way an editor, well, for most publications, I mean, you know, I mean, I can't imagine the Times Argus or the New York Times printing something like that. It just wouldn't happen.
You know. 7 days might.
7 days might.
Well, Harry Bliss, where do you go with that then? Is it the cartoonist's role to say, whoa, I'm taking this a step too far? Or is it, in that case, an editor's role to say, are you kidding? We're not publishing this. I mean, should the cartoonist, him or herself, say, all right, this is provocation. It's beyond the norms of what society will take. Or should somebody else do that? You just do your cartoons, and I get to say, no, Harry, sorry, we're not doing that.
Well, for me, I just draw the stuff up, and I don't edit myself. That's something that Françoise Mouly, my editor at The New Yorker, art editor, cover editor, she will tell us, just do me a favor, don't edit yourself, just send in the ideas, and that's my job. But it depends on the cartoonist. I mean, I think in the case of Charlie Hebdo, some of those cartoons that were being so heavily criticized were actually very nuanced cartoons that are very specific to the French culture. And while at first glance they are shocking, if you dig a little deeper, there are some layers there where the cartoons are actually, in fact, doing something very different than what they appear to be doing. And so it requires a certain amount of research on the reader or the viewer of these cartoons. That said, cartoons are like, you know, they're so immediate and primitive. You know, they just, they're not like prose. You know, they hit you on a visceral level. And I think what happens is it's like a punch, you know, and people on the other end of that punch, I don't think they're taking the time to really look deep. You know, if South Park has a show where they're depicting the Prophet Muhammad, the reaction is so quick and visceral. It's like this thing when I grew up, they said, you know, your mother wears army boots, you know. Don't talk about my mother. Well, the prophet has become, you know, replaced our mothers these days, so you can't do that.
And this prescription against drawing the prophet is a very peculiar button for cartoonists. That really pushes cartoonist buttons because that's what we do. We draw things.
Mm. Alison Bechdel, you made a distinction between what Charlie Hebdo was doing and this Draw Muhammad contest. And certainly the Draw Muhammad contest drew a lot of criticism. It also drew two would-be attackers who were killed at the event. You see a distinction between what Charlie Hebdo was doing and what the Draw Muhammad contest was all about. So does the point matter? Is that where you're drawing the line?
Well, I would not have gone to an award ceremony for the American, what are they called? The American.
Yeah, I can't
remember. American
the
Freedom Defense
yeah,
Initiative.
That's right.
Pam Geller.
No, I would not have supported them receiving an award. What was the question again? It all gets so very complicated. These things are really hard to think through.
Well, they are hard to think through. And you know, if you're looking here, so let me make it a little bit simplified from the two events that we're talking about and take it away from those two events. If you're looking at two cartoons which depict something that to at least a certain group of people is highly offensive, and in this case, in both cases, it was a depiction, a picture of the Prophet Muhammad. If you're looking at these two cartoons, two drawings, does it matter what the point is of the person who was creating them? Is that where we're making the distinction here between what's okay and what's not okay to put out there? You know what?
Yeah, I think it does matter. I think we need to be able to think about details like that. The world is not simple. People's intentions make a great deal of difference.
We got a note from Peggy who posted on our page to say there is a difference between incitement designed to provoke a violent reaction and satire designed to make people think. But Tim Newcomb, in the eye of the person who's reading that cartoon, that distinction may not always be clear.
So, No. And I mean, the reaction will vary from person to person. I mean, even depicting Muhammad, it's technically it is allowed in the Quran. Although most Sunni interpretations don't allow it. I mean, they don't approve of it at all. Whereas in Iran, which is a Shiite country, they really don't have a problem with it. And
so for you, I mean, you are a cartoonist who often depicts political debates and politicians in Vermont specifically. You really take aim at what's happening in Montpelier frequently. How do you look at that and think about how people are going to receive it at the other end? And is that important to you, or are you saying, look, I'm drawing my point of view here, and then you interpret it how you want?
Well, I mean, being in Montpelier, I see all these people. So, it's you know, that does come into play. When I see Jim Douglas on the street on a regular basis, I mean, at first I would turn every shade of scarlet imaginable. And, you know, as I got to know him, I mean, he was a great guy. And, it did temper my cartoons to a little bit. I mean, I had a lot of fun drawing him, making fun of him. But he was absolutely gracious. Figured, you know, if you're going to be in this job, you know, you've got to be prepared to you know, be lampooned. I mean, that's locally, but I mean, then you have regional interpretations or even international. I mean, if you're drawing a cartoon in France, there's going to be all kinds of subtleties about the illustration. It's not that other people are not going to get it, even in Europe. Even we may all be Western, but there are colors in the cartoon, not I mean, actual colors, but I mean, nuances mm-hmm. that, as Harry was saying, people will miss or misinterpret.
And there are actually colors as well. Some of those cartoons, yeah. But I mean, yeah. I mean, those colors actually do have a significance in some of those Charlie Hebdo images.
Let's go to Terry, who's calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Terry. Your thoughts today?
Hi, how are you? I was fortunate enough to grow up with Mad Magazine and R. Crumb Comics.
And, good for you.
Yeah, good old R. Crumb.
Yeah,
love it.
And if I could make a contrast, there's this fine line for the artist back then that I feel perhaps is a little blurry now. When they were doing satires on specific people, they had a tendency to show the irony and to mock them, but it would be tasteful. It would be within a certain periphery. But a specific example is R. Crumb's Rough Tuff Cream Puff. Do you remember Rough Tuff Cream Puff?
It was before my day, Terry.
Explain.
Well, look him up, and he was obviously a parody of the white dominant culture. And had he been called the Great White Father or Yahweh, R. Crumb could have possibly gotten into really big trouble. So I just want to point that out. Thank you very much.
Terry, thanks for the call. Harry, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, it's funny because Robert Crumb, I also grew up with Mad Magazine. I just bought the entire decade on eBay of 1970 to 1980. Robert Crumb spoke at the Moore College of Art and Design when I was in art school, and my sister was working for an organization called Women Organize Against Rape, a war in Philly. And when Robert Crumb was going to speak there, she had every intention of going there and literally beating him up. So he was very irreverent, his work, and I think it's gotten tamer over the years. But, I forget the question about that Crumb, yeah, I forget the question.
And I think Terry was just making a comment about, sort of where the line is between good taste and bad taste and when you can get yourself in trouble and how you can sort of skirt that line.
Well, you know, one thing about R. Crumb is I think there, in some cases, like, for example, racist people would embrace some of his comics that they thought were supporting their views when, in fact, he was making fun of their views.
Which is a similar argument to what many people are saying about Charlie Hebdo.
Yeah, exactly.
We're talking today about satire. We're talking about free speech. We're talking about the role of the cartoonist with three Vermont cartoonists, very well known, who have a lot to say about this. And many of you do as well. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Tell us how you frame this issue. Or you can ask a question of Alison Bechdel, Harry Bliss, or Tim Newcomb. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit more about Gary Trudeau's idea of whether satire should punch up or punch down. We're going to talk about the role of cartoonists and representations in cartoons. Again, our number 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with three local cartoonists about where satire, free speech, and hate speech converge and diverge, and we're hearing about how they draw the line in their own personal work. We're talking with Alison Bechdel, creator of the strip Dykes to Watch Out For and the graphic memoir Fun Home, among others. With Harry Bliss, a cartoonist and cover artist for The New Yorker, author of children's books and the single-panel comic Bliss. And with Tim Newcomb, an editorial cartoonist published weekly in 7 days and regularly picked up by national publications. You can share your thoughts, your questions. Do you think it's okay for cartoonists to lampoon whoever they want, however they want to do it? Does there need to be editorial judgment or some sort of point? You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And let's go to Betty, who's calling in from Rutland. Hi, Betty. Your thoughts.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is I don't see any reason to attack any religion, no matter what it is.
Why not, Betty?
Be neat. Please?
Why not?
I think religions are everybody's individual use of how they see them, and I don't think it's necessary. There's plenty of things in this world to be satirical about or blatant, and there are certainly a lot of cartoonists out there that are blatant.
Betty, I hear what you're saying. Let's put this to our guests today because it's an interesting perspective and certainly one that was also swirling around after the Charlie Hebdo murders, this idea that should we be lampooning religion at all? Allison, where do you fall on that?
You know, a friend of mine, Judith Levine, who writes for 7 Days, made an interesting comment on this topic. She pointed out that Charlie Hebdo is their main thing is they're anti-religious. They're anti all religions. They're poking fun at all religions. And Judith pointed out that here in the U.S. or in Iran, that would be a brave political stance. But in France, and this is something I didn't really register, in France, secularism is the law. That's the status quo. So in a way, Charlie Hebdo is just upholding the, you know, the. It's not like a challenging thing that they're doing. They're just enforcing this anti-religious point of view.
Harry Bliss, do you have thoughts on this idea that religion should be off limits?
That's crazy. I mean, there's so much material there. come on. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was interrupting you.
I did a couple cartoons that dealt with religion. There was one that had two men outside of the Jewish Museum. And they were about to go in, and one man says to the other friend, he says, I was all set to go to the Guggenheim, but my mother guilt-tripped me into coming here. Now, that cartoon ran, and I received a bunch of letters from readers who were very upset, Jewish men, and mainly men. And the tone in those letters was pretty angry, and I'm convinced it was because religion. Now, strangely enough, the next day, I got a letter from the Jewish Museum asking if they can use the cartoon as a postcard in the museum. And there was another one where I depicted the Mecca. And apparently someone, they were meeting at Mecca, but it was supposed to be Mecca Bar and Grill. But there was a pullback view of Mecca, and there was a speech balloon. So the same thing, religion. Many letters from Muslims, that's a holy place. They don't drink alcohol. And I apologized to those people. But taking that off the table is just absurd to me, absolutely absurd. Nothing is sacred. Nothing is sacred.
We got a note from Mike who says, whatever medium you work in, communication has to get through to a critical mass of people. If you draw or write something that people don't get, it's not enough to defend it as your free expression. If it didn't get through, you have failed as an artist. I mean, certainly that's a perspective on the quality counting, you know, whether the quality matters. We got a note from Eileen who says, I'd like to know what they think of Joan Rivers' work. It seems now that she is gone, her former TV colleagues can no longer pull off her brand of satire. I won't ask the three of you to weigh in on who could replace Joan Rivers, but I think it's an interesting thought to jump off of that Joan Rivers, I mean, some people certainly thought Joan Rivers was a talentless hack. That's a perspective that was out there. But a lot of people thought she was very talented. And in as much as she was mean, she was also very funny. So, Tim Newcombe, do you think that talent is really the key here? I mean, if you're not funny, then it's not, if that's what you're aiming for, if you're just mean, it's not going to work. But if there's a talent to it, then somehow it's more okay, I guess?
Yeah, well, I think with good satire, there has to be some kind of a message, some not just blatant mud throwing. I mean, going back to religion, I mean, one of my favorite groups, Monty Python, back in the late 70s, around 1980, produced Life of Brian, which is personally one of my favorite movies of all time. But yeah, it was actually banned for something like 28 years. And even their main funder pulled out when they realized that there was so much fun being poked at Christianity and religions in general. And it was only because George Harrison of the Beatles came in and funded the movie. But at this point, and it was given an X rating. I mean, they really tried to discourage this. People got very upset. But in my mind, it's just it's a brilliant movie.
I think I think you're right, too, that satire does, you know, it can't, what Pam Geller did in that group in Texas was pure provocation, and but good satire needs to move the dialogue. You know, obviously humor has something to do with it, a lot to do with it, but it needs to move the dialogue of what that humor is about in a forward direction. And
can we just talk about the brilliant Saturday Night Live?
Which one? The Taliban? Was it the ISIS?
They had one this past weekend where part of it was not charades, Pictionary.
Pictionary game show.
Yes, and they had to draw things, and somebody got Muhammad, right? Allison, you've seen it. You can describe it, and nobody wanted to draw it.
But it was so brilliant because the two guys who went up to the drawing pad are standing there like terrified. Oh, my God, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And in effect, that sketch, they did not draw Muhammad, but they drew attention to the whole problem in a really wonderful way without actually drawing Muhammad.
I actually have, Allison, I didn't see that, but there's a, I don't know if you've seen this cartoon, you were Tim, but there's a, Glenn Lelivre is a terrific Australian cartoonist, and he contributes to The New Yorker, too. And I just recently bought the original artwork for a cartoon that he did that appeared in the Rejection Collection, and it's a do-it-yourself blasphemy, and it's the Prophet Muhammad, but it's connect the dots, which is along the same kind of similar idea. But you know what's interesting? I bought that cartoon from, I traded with him, and it came to my house. This is true, and I put tracing paper over the drawing, and I connected the dots. In the privacy of my own home. And I just find that dynamic very, very strange. There's this fear that's in the atmosphere about being able to draw or make art and put your art out there. And it's diametrically opposed to the amount of material that's out there on the internet. So it's just it's a strange environment for satire. Fear seems to be, really persistent.
Mm-hmm. And powerful.
And powerful.
We're talking today about cartoons, satire, free speech, provocation. Hearing from many of you as well, our number, if you'd like to weigh in, is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or share your thoughts on our Facebook page. We'll put up a link to that Saturday Night Live sketch that Allison was talking about for people who haven't seen it. So you can be in on the joke as well and weigh in on what you think about that. We got a note from Jeff who says, if you believe in a religion, be prepared to have it satirized and mocked. Everything else in society is vulnerable to it. There's no reason religion should be exempt. Satire is important because it forces people to think critically about the validity of the subject and to see its flaws through the scope of somebody with a different viewpoint. And let's go to Nichol, who's on the line with us from Guilford. Hi, Nichol.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is, of course, an enormous issue. I'll try to be as brief as I can. I have a more general question about what I see as a problem that comes up and often when this discussion comes up. That is, it's often the case that there seems to be a strong implication that the degree to which you support free expression should or does necessarily depend on how much you agree with what's being expressed. On one hand, like in this case, if someone tries to acknowledge that a piece can be problematic, then that person will almost certainly be accused of being half-hearted in a defense of free speech or saying that the work should be censored. On the other hand, if someone chooses to defend the right to express a view that folks more generally recognize as offensive, then they can almost certainly count on being accused of defending that view itself. But just to try to wrap up, how do we reach a point where we're able to acknowledge there really are cases where both of these things are fully true? That is, the right to say something without fear of reprisal is absolute, and that it's equally true that what was said is offensive. I would argue that these are simply unrelated positions, and that by simply acknowledging both things, we're not making a contradiction.
Nichol, thanks for the call. Allison, I hear you agreeing.
Oh, yeah. No, Nichol, thank you for that, making that point. That's really good. And I feel like what happens in this debate is we keep getting – there's a tendency to want to take one side or the other, but there's not really necessarily sides. I'm sorry. It's so hard to be.
Well, let me bring in here. I mentioned that I was going to bring up what Gary Trudeau was arguing. Gary Trudeau, who was opposed to the Penn Courage Award that was given to Charlie Hebdo. And in opposing it, he wrote, "Satire punches up against authority of all kinds, the little guy against the powerful. Ridiculing the non-privileged is almost never funny. It's just mean." So joining with what Nichol was saying, that it can be true that you have freedom of expression, but that something is also racist or mean or wrong. And Gary Trudeau saying, look, the point should be you hit people who are powerful, not the powerless. Harry Bliss, how do you tie those together?
Well, I think that's a good stance, and I think that's a good satirist will probably want to direct their satire at those people in power. You know, he also said something. I think a lot of this stuff boils down to what it's. I keep coming back to the media and how the media changes public perception of what is racist and what isn't racist. And I keep going back to South Park because I think those guys just do such a terrific job. But you know, I don't have a lot of faith in public opinion because of the media. I think the public has been brainwashed into believing that something is racist. The word thug, you know, is now being considered, you know, I'm sorry, that's just strikes me as that's crazy to take away our vocabulary slowly. Just
except you know. The way words are used, the way pictures and images are used has a context and a cultural context. So while nobody may take the word away from you or your vocabulary or your ability to draw, it certainly is framed by a cultural context and a time.
Absolutely. Yeah, go ahead.
I think I just want to make a point that, you know, there are big underlying power structures in all of these debates. There was a huge outcry in the West against the Charlie Hebdo murders, which was great. You know, it was terrible that those people were killed. But there has not been a similar outcry about the ongoing death of civilians in airstrikes by the U.S. and our allies in places like Iraq and Syria. That's not something that the American public wants to even think about.
That's CNN for you. That's the media not covering, you know, it's like Baltimore. We had 2-3 weeks of Baltimore, whereas you had, you know, countless, you know, black-on-black murders in Watts and Chicago going on all over. And they don't cover anything outside. You know, I heard Al Jazeera's in trouble, and that network is going to be off the air. So it's frightening to me.
You know, I could talk to the three of you for hours because this is fascinating and it's an interesting lens into a lot of the questions about culture, about race, about how we talk to one another. And I wish we could. But so let me just ask you a really huge question with a minute left. But Tim Newcombe, given all we're discussing today, what do you think then is the role of a cartoonist? Because, you know, we're hearing Harry and Allison bring in these topics that say, they say, these aren't getting enough attention. Where do you see yourself, for example, as a facilitator or a part of these conversations? What's the role of the cartoonist?
Well, I mean, hopefully there's a point we all want to be making about whatever the issue is. I think going back to Mad Magazine, you know, they've always been known to just lampoon anybody, but they do have lines, and their basic thing was, you know, there has to be a message. You know, you can make fun of somebody, but if there's not a clear message behind what you're doing, then you're failing. And
well, it's been fascinating to talk to all three of you today. Allison Bechdel, Harry Bliss, Tim Newcombe, thank you so much for your perspective.
Thank you, Jane.
We have links to the work of all three cartoonists at vpr.net, where you can weigh in with your thoughts on the line between satire, cartoons, and free speech. Coming up, Kids' Choice. We'll find out who won this year's Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award, and we'll hear from the author on the honor. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's time for our final installment of Dorothy's List for the school year. Each month since September, we've profiled one of the books nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Choice Book Award. This month, we learn which book Vermont kids chose, and we preview some of the books nominated for next year's award. The winner was announced last week at the annual Dorothy Canfield Fisher Conference in Fairleigh, and VPR's Amy Noyce was there.
We have a DCF award winner for 2015. It's Chris Grabenstein for Escape from Mr. Limoncello's Library.
That was Sharon Colvin talking to a room full of Vermont librarians and teachers. She's the new youth services consultant for the Vermont Department of Libraries. If the applause sounded less than enthusiastic, that's because the winner wasn't a surprise to many of the people in the room. It's hard to keep a secret from a good librarian. They were more surprised to learn that author Chris Grabenstein will be coming to Vermont later this spring to accept his award.
I'm extremely happy to announce that he will be coming to Vermont on Saturday, June 13th.
It's been a few years since the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Awards winning author has been able to accept the award in person. So Colvin says she's going to do whatever she can to make it a great celebration. Escape from Mr. Limoncello's Library is about a group of 12-year-olds who are locked inside a brand new state-of-the-art library with features like a holographic librarian and shelf-stocking robots. The library was built by a master game maker, Mr. Limoncello, and the kids are competing to be the first to find their way out using only the tools found within the library. Kids who voted for the book say they liked solving puzzles in the story alongside the characters. New York-based author Chris Grabenstein says he's excited to come accept the award in person.
I really want to thank the kids who voted for the book more than anything. Winning this kind of award, because there's all sorts of awards that are given out by librarians and organizations. But when a bunch of kids sit down and read a list of books and say, this is our favorite, for me, that's really who I'm writing for. So that means more than anything in the world. So thank you, Vermont. I'm going to buy you all some ice cream. We're going to go to Ben and Jerry's and convince them to make Limoncello Lemonhead ice cream or sorbet.
While there may not be a Limoncello ice cream yet, author Chris Grabenstein says there might be a movie in the works.
Well, there's a chance that Nickelodeon might turn it into a movie. We don't know for sure, so that's pretty exciting.
And Chris Grabenstein says he recently finished writing a sequel to Escape from Mr. Limoncello's Library.
And it comes out, I realized, on 1616, January 6, 2016. And it'll be called Mr. Limoncello's Library Olympics. There's going to be regional competitions. And then six teams will come to Ohio for the first ever Library Olympics to be held on March 20th because the other Olympics already have winter and summer. So Mr. Limoncello will do spring.
Even before Escape from Mr. Limoncello's Library was announced as the 2015 winner, the award committee had released the list of 30 books nominated for the 2016 award. Youth Services consultant Sharon Colvin is one of eight members of that volunteer committee. Dorothy's List sat down with Sharon and committee chairperson Hannah Peacock, who's also the children's librarian at Burnham Memorial Library in Colchester. We asked them to tell us about some of their favorite titles on the new list. Hannah let Sharon have the first pick.
You go first.
I would start with The Scandalous Sisterhood of Prickwillow Place. I love this book. It won an award for the audio production from ALA.
Oh, I listened to the audio. Fantastic.
It's
yeah.
hilarious. Yeah. So funny. So this is a dark, dark comedy. And it's about these girls who are in a boarding school, a finishing school in the 1800s in England. And they have this kind of Miss Hannigan-esque headmistress who's just not nice. And one day they're having Sunday dinner with the headmistress and the headmistress's brother, and they mysteriously drop dead. And so the girls have to figure out what to do. And they're thinking, oh my gosh, we're going to get in trouble. And then they're going to send us home and they don't want to go home. And ooh, if we just ignore it, maybe they'll let us do whatever we want. And of course, that sounds appealing. So they bury them in the backyard, which is horrifying but hilarious. And so then they pretend, they make one of the girls dress up as the headmistress and they pretend like nothing ever happened. But of course, that is not going to last very long. And while they're trying to pretend that the headmistress is still alive, they're trying to unravel the mystery of who killed them and trying to protect themselves because they don't want to get blamed.
That's The Scandalous Sisterhood of Prickwillow Place by author Julie Berry. Committee Chair Hannah Peacock gave her first nod to a book called The Misadventures of the Family Fletcher by author Dana Allison Levy.
It's a book about two dads who have adopted four boys, And it's not about the dads being gay that's important in this book. It's just about them being a family and finding their place. Nothing crazy happens. It's a sweet, gentle book about boys growing up and dads finding how to parent. And like, there's no like huge thing in town about, oh my God, these two dads, you guys. No one cares. It's just about, you know, a 6-year-old, 2 10-year-olds and a 12-year-old going to different schools, and one of them going to school for the first time, and all finding different interests and breaking out of their sort of shells. And it's just the sweetest, loveliest book about kids.
Sharon Colvin also selected a quiet book for her next pick by author Naomi Shihab Nye.
Another one of my absolute favorites is The Turtle of Oman. This book just blew me away. It's short. It's almost like poetry. It's written so beautifully. And it's about a boy who lives in Oman, and he is going to be moving to the United States, and he really does not want to go. And the whole book kind of reads as this love letter to Oman, and he loves his home so much and his family, and he spends time with his grandfather kind of saying goodbye, and he knows he's going to return, which is, you know, why it's called The Turtle of Oman.
The title refers to the time that the boy and his grandfather spend watching sea turtles as the animals return to the shores where they were born.
He's going to return like the turtle in a few years, but it just breaks his heart to leave. So it's the story of this little boy who's kind of dragging his feet.
He won't pack.
His mom's like, have you started packing? No. He doesn't want to pack, and he doesn't know what to take, and he's dragging his feet. But at the same time, he's really immersing himself in his family and his home, and not a lot happens in this book, but it doesn't matter. It's just a sweet, gentle read. I hope a lot of kids pick it up.
Green Glass House by author Kate Milford is Hannah Peacock's next selection.
And it's a book that'll be so interesting to so many different types of readers, because there's mystery, there's imagination, there's friendship, there's adoption. So it's the story of this couple who run this inn up on this hill in Nagspeak, and they have an adopted son, and he's all excited because he thinks he's going to get to spend Christmas doing nothing. And then all of a sudden, all these guests show up, and they're all coming for different connected reasons, and he ends up having to solve the mystery of why everyone's there and what it's all about. And the inn is, historically, it was a place where smugglers came through, and so some of that connects back, and then he has this new friend that you'll find out a lot about, and they end up solving this mystery together. But there's all kinds of little nuances and mysteries and little games and puzzles to solve, and it's just one of my favorite books on the list as well.
And Hannah Peacock has a bird-themed supernatural book in her top three, Gabriel Finley and the Raven's Riddle by George Hagen.
And again, it's a mystery. So this boy is about to turn 12. He lives with his aunt, and his father has gone missing. And there's a connection to him turning 12 and certain things happening. And he and his dad both have this connection with ravens, where they can actually sort of meld their bodies with them and fly. He and his new friends he finds decide they're going to find his dad or look for his dad and his uncle, who's turned a little mad. And they go to this underground world called Aviopolis that's run by birds. And all throughout, there's puzzles and games, and there's ravens and there's Val ravens, and the Val ravens are bad. So ravens always identify each other by having to solve a pun. If they laugh, then they're a raven. If they don't get it, then they're a Val raven. So there's puns throughout the book, which is just awesome. And again, it's a story about friendship and adventure, and there's puzzles, and it's fantasy, and it's a good mystery.
Sharon Colvin's third pick is a graphic novel called El Defo by C.C. Bell.
I will tell you, I'm not a huge graphic novel fan, but this one blew me away. It's fantastic. It's really approachable. It's a memoir. It's about a girl who in the 1980s had a hearing problem. And so she wore this really conspicuous, bulky hearing aid that, you know, was obvious to all her classmates. And of course, it came with the accompanying bullying and feeling like an outcast. And the art is fantastic because the characters are not human. They're bunnies. Which I don't know, there's something endearing about that. And they're bunnies, and she's wearing this kind of huge, bulky hearing aid. And what happens is that she turns it into a superpower, and she calls herself El Defo. And so she becomes a superhero who has this special power. And I think this story is really relatable. I think that every kid's going to understand how it feels to feel left out, feel different, and to get kind of that negative attention. But the great thing about this character is she turns it around and she becomes the hero of her own story, which I just love. And because it's a graphic novel, I think it's going to reach a lot of readers who wouldn't necessarily pick up a big, wordy prose novel.
Those are just a few of the 30 books nominated for next year's Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award for middle grade readers.
The job never stops.
There's always one more book to read.
Yeah, I know.
You can find the entire list at vpr.net. It's a great way to start your summer reading. For VPR News, I'm Amy Noyes.
And that wraps up Dorothy's list for this school year. VPR's Book Club for Kids will return in the fall when we'll take a closer look each month at books nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award. Dorothy's list is sponsored by the VPR Journalism Fund. We're still getting emails and notes about our earlier discussion on cartoons, cartooning, satire, provocation. If you'd like to weigh in, you can go to vpr.net, click on Vermont Edition, and add your 2 cents there. You can also go to our Facebook page where we have links and videos. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.